This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and podcast. Now, in a moment, how religion is powering the march of some nationalists in this weekend's Italian election, and later a fascinating insight into the political instincts of the new King Charles III, not quite what you might think of a monarch.
If Charles was a politician, and he isn't, we'd call him a Tory socialist. But fundamentally, what there is in Charles is what I would call a form of romanticism. Charles is really a romantic in the philosophical, in the religious and metaphysical sense. Fundamentally, it is about beauty, goodness and truth, those three transcendentals, trying to somehow ally them. And that's what romanticism sought to do. And he is, in that sense, an unreconstructed romantic, not a sentimentalist, not someone who believes that everything's fine or there's a golden age to which we shall return.
First, though, the biggest and most powerful Anglican diocese in Australia, that's Sydney, has made an important apology to Indigenous Australians. Religion journalist John Sanderman reports that at the synod, which ended this week, the diocese formally apologised for, quote, past failures in relationships with this nation's First Peoples. The diocese also resolved to prioritise the needs of Indigenous Anglicans when buying new property. And the synod also passed a motion to consider supporting the yes case in any referendum to enshrine an Indigenous voice to Parliament. The march of right-wing nationalists across Europe seems set to continue this weekend as Italians vote in national elections. This contest also has a strong religious undertone. The party leading in the polls is called the Brothers of Italy. Now, its origins lie in the post-war neo-fascist movement. The leader is a woman called Giorgia Meloni. But in this campaign, she prefers to emphasise less nationalism and more traditional family values. Dr. Mariana Graffini is an expert in Italian politics and culture at King's College London, and she introduces us to the woman who could be Italy's next Prime Minister.
Giorgia Meloni is the leader of Fratelli d'Italia, so Brothers of Italy. She is a self-made woman, and she really likes to portray herself as a self-made woman. She was born in a quite wealthy neighborhood in Rome, but when she was very young, she moved to Garbatella, which is a less affluent neighborhood in Rome. And she really emphasizes the fact that she was brought up by a single mother in a very cramped flat, and her mother had to juggle different jobs. Her childhood was key actually then to shape her as a person of the people. As a child, she experienced the struggles of women who have to raise children, and indeed she really likes to depict herself as a woman and a mother.
How integral to this campaign, now as the leader of the Brothers of Italy, has been religion?
I think that it has quite a central role, actually, in the Brothers of Italy campaign. Brothers of Italy was then established in 2012, and Giorgia Meloni was the founder of Brothers of Italy, and she has been the only leader of Brothers of Italy so far. And she has always placed paramount importance on religion. Indeed, when she addresses huge crowds, it has now become a popular slogan, and it has been turned into a meme on the internet as well. She says, "I am Giorgia, I am a mother, I am a woman, I am Italian, I am Christian." And she did repeat this slogan also when she addressed the crowds in Spain at a rally, at a political rally held by Vox, the populist radical right party in Spain. So we see that she identifies herself as a Christian. So we see immediately the importance of religion. So religion becomes a centerpiece in the campaigns. So I think that it is very evident in the conservative values that Giorgia Meloni advocates. And these conservative values rotate around, for instance, the Christian identity of the Western world, or the so-called Western world.
So, Mariana, she's like a lot of her fellow nationalists across Europe. She's saying that she's the last bulwark against the end of Christian Europe.
So, yes, the bulwark protecting Christian Europe, and she does actually include also Hungary and Poland as being the sort of bulwarks of Christianity. Again, at the rally and different public speeches, she was saying, we are against Germany or the Netherlands because they are creating a sort of political hegemony within the EU, but we are friends of Poland and of Hungary. And let's not forget that Hungary is ruled by Orbán. And Giorgia Meloni really likes especially the family policies that are very much conservative and very much drenched in religion that Orbán is enacting.
She seems to be very insistent on pushing back against what she sees as the radicalism or the excess of what she calls the LGBT lobby.
Yeah, Brothers of Italy has always been hostile to LGBTQ rights. For instance, in Parliament recently, they opposed a law proposal against homophobia. So the recent political history gives us some examples, some practical examples of how Brothers of Italy is against the LGBTQ movement and rights. And also, they have been campaigning to eradicate what is called gender theory and gender classes in schools in Italy.
Mariana, does she have any public support from any religious leaders, any Catholic leaders? But has anyone from the official religious world waded in support of her?
No, to my knowledge, no. We have the Vatican. They have been keeping neutral. No, I don't think that she has any public support from religious leaders. There may be some bishops who share ideas that are similar to the ideas that not just Brothers of Italy, but also the League, led by Matteo Salvini, espouse. But this is always not public, you know, this is not a public endorsement.
You mentioned the public anxiety over globalization. There was an interesting piece in The Economist magazine recently, and it pointed out that her political party, the Brothers of Italy, like a lot of nationalist parties across Europe, actually rejects right-wing economics. Is that right?
Regarding Brothers of Italy, they are quite neoliberal in general. So, for instance, they advocate the flat tax, which is a 15% taxation for everyone. And this, of course, would put the wealthiest in a position of advantage. They say that they want to implement the flat tax in a progressive way because they know that Italy, of course, doesn't have the budget to sustain the flat tax at 15% implemented just, you know, the day after the elections. But at the same time, it is quite curious because they actually are in favor of a welfare state. Probably in this, they are detaching themselves from what is assumed to be the traditional right-wing position in economics. So, yes, the welfare state in favor of young families, in favor of mothers, in favor of increasing birth rates. And in this, we can see again the values of Christianity mirrored, right, in these policies. It's a curious blend of typically right-wing neoliberal policies plus not typically right-wing accent on the welfare state. And it is, again, welfare I want to specify for families to increase the birth rate. It is not the sort of welfare that may be advocated by center-left parties, for instance, emphasizing more the free access for everyone to healthcare, or that may be emphasizing civil rights and welfare for immigrants.
Just finally, Mariana, what does she say about Islam? Because you can't really have an election campaign anywhere in Europe these days without this question of Islam coming up.
I have to say that in this electoral campaign, Giorgia Meloni didn't insist that much on Islam. And indeed, yeah, this is something worth investigating further. So in the past, for instance, Daniela Santanchè, that's a prominent representative of Brothers of Italy, waged the ardent campaign against the headscarf, against the veil. So usually Brothers of Italy projects itself as the defender of Muslim women rights against Muslim men. This is quite a curious position, but it does resonate a lot with the position held by other populist radical right parties in Europe, where they try to project themselves as the protectors of human rights, in this case, women's rights. But this is meant to sanitize, basically, externally their image, to become more appealing to the electorate. But at the same time, hidden beneath this civic cloak, there are more racist nativist tones. You know that they try to protect Muslim women's rights because they want to attack Islam at large. They want to attack Muslim men. The headscarf campaign, for instance, is a famous one. But I have to say that in public speeches Giorgia Meloni gave as part of this electoral campaign, I didn't hear them talking about Islam that much. And it may be something strategic because they have had to moderate themselves. They have had to tone down their non-civic, their more extreme traits, because now they are the leading party. So if they want to keep a broad share of the electorate, they need to tone down the more extreme traits.
Dr. Mariana Graffini, she's a lecturer in European studies and international studies at King's College in London, and she's a specialist in Italian politics. Thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much.
And you're with Andrew West. After King Charles has put away his military uniform with the gold braid and the peaked cap, we saw it this week at the state funeral of Queen Elizabeth, the most enduring image of him is rather more earthy. It's the tweed coat and the green Wellington boots and the picture postcard English landscape. A romantic vision in the truest sense. Because Charles believes that nature and the environment are the best expressions of God and religion. To the extent that any monarch can have a political worldview, this is probably his. But of course, now he must deal with the past, the violent history of Britain's imperial era. Professor Adrian Pabst of the University of Kent is a political philosopher, religious scholar and author of Post-Liberal Politics, The Coming Era of Renewal, and he's been studying Charles for many years.
It's best captured by the title of his 2010 book, Harmony. What he wants to help bring about is a more harmonious society, a society characterized by greater balance, greater ecological balance, greater economic balance, social, and indeed also greater religious balance, not just between those who have no faith and those who do, but also between the different religions. So it's very much about, if you like, a more organic, anchored or rooted pluralism that nevertheless contains a very clear direction towards a universal transcendent truth.
when I think of his public pronouncements, I think of a man who is at once radical but also conservative.
Oh, absolutely. That is the paradoxical politics of Charles III. It is not reactionary. He doesn't reject everything in the modern world, but he does say that the modern world and modernism in particular have led us down a wrong path, a path of pure materialism, destruction of the environment, which he has raised as a huge public problem for decades, economic destruction, you know, social fragmentation. And that rather than trying to undo history or reverse things, which never in the end is realistic or desirable, he's basically saying, let's create an alternative modernity, one that is much more concerned with balance, with the good things of tradition, inheritance, culture, language, customs, the common law tradition, and so on, but also something that then transforms the world. So it's radical because it wants to bring about greater economic justice, greater ecological sustainability. So he's marrying the traditional, all the good things we've received from history, with the radical.
Where does his religious perspective come into this? I ask this because in the past, I think you have participated in seminars and important roundtables out at Windsor Castle. I don't know if the Prince of Wales or the new king was present, but I know this is a part of his thinking that you've concentrated on. Where does the religious sensibility come in?
So the religious faith is absolutely central to everything Charles is, I think, said and done, because in his first address as king, he said that what he believes in, what he stands for, is anchored in his Christian faith, which is rooted in the Church of England. But at the same time, we know that he's been very much influenced by other Christian traditions. So on his father's side, on the side of the family, Prince Philip, of course, there is Eastern Orthodoxy. And there's a certain sort of more mystical, more embedded version of Christianity that isn't quite like the Protestant faith, but totally compatible, because it is about both the book of scripture, the texts, but also the book of nature, how nature reveals God. And for Charles, that is absolutely central to his faith. And that's also why he has such strong connections with other spiritual traditions, other world religions, because he can see that in Islam, there's a certain sense of it, a unity of life, a unity of purpose, that, you know, in other Eastern faiths, not just Eastern Orthodoxy, there is something more organic, perhaps, than in some of the more modern expressions in the West. So he's very much a Christian, very much rooted in the Church of England with its beautiful liturgical traditions, the hymns, all the ancient churches around the country, but also open to others. Precisely, he can see that the universal truth that he believes in is also reflected in other traditions.
It strikes me that he's had to wear the same criticism, actually, as Pope Francis. They've both been criticized as being somehow religious relativists. Pope Francis, because he once asked Muslims to pray for him. Charles, because people argue that he doesn't seem to think that one religion speaks more truth than the next.
I think that's simply a misreading, because Charles has been very clear that he is a Christian, that he's an Anglican, that for him, that is the expression that his faith takes, and it is universal. He doesn't in no way believe that his faith isn't universal. All he's saying is, and this is very much in line with a long tradition of Christian theology stretching all the way back to St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine and many more besides, that because the world is God's creation and the glory reflects, you know, all of God's glory, therefore, in other traditions, there are dim reflections of that universal truth. It is not all monopolized by one. That would be a kind of more modern abstract universalism, whereas he actually genuinely believes that other traditions can have a measure of that universal truth, even if they don't quite express it in the way that Christianity does. So he's in absolutely no sense whatsoever a relativist. He is a Christian pluralist, and I think that is vital to understand his position on these questions, but also on questions of the environment, the economy, integrating young people, the vulnerable and the poor into society. It underpins it all.
You mention an important point there. In his first speech as king, now this was not a formal requirement, there was no oath in this, but he made a reference to William, the new Prince of Wales, and his son having a mission to bring those at the margins to the centre. Now, how significant was this?
Well, this is precisely where the progressives should listen and should take heed that he is absolutely not a reactionary who wants to leave things as they are. It's not just that he praises William for his work, and William has done very important work with the Big Issue and other initiatives. Charles himself set up the Prince's Trust precisely to promote the young. And let's not forget, King Charles III came of age in the 70s. And in the 70s, what did we have? An economic crisis or crises. You know, the first signs of serious ecological devastation. A society was becoming polarized and fragmented after the 60s, the Vietnam War, and so on. So he has already lived through an age that isn't all that different from ours, albeit that today the context is different and the crises are more severe. But he was very prescient then when he realized that if we don't help the young go from primary and secondary school into either university or indeed other forms of learning, and if we don't put them at the center of our economic model, we will be scarring a whole generation and we'll be destroying the society on which everything rests. Very much in line, for instance, with the Catholic social teaching ideas around the preferential options for the poor. And that's where he is, in fact, more radical than the progressives.
A funny point, Adrian, that I've read just in the assessments of him in the last few days is that, yes, he is in some ways a child of the 70s, a period when he matured. And with his green wellies and his tweed jackets, he's a slightly establishment hippie figure.
I suppose that's one way of saying that he's very paradoxical. Yes, absolutely. The tweed representing the sense of continuity and stability, but also protection against really foul weather. And of course, the green wellies, you know, being the thing that gets you through the mud without having wet feet all day. And no, it is marrying tradition with modernity, but it's not doing it on a kind of secular, utilitarian, materialist basis. That's the key thing. He is at once an idealist because he believes in something that's more than just utility maximization and that part of modernity, the kind of the rationalist calculus. And on the other hand, he also believes in materialism because he wants to protect the environment. He wants to actually preserve Mother Nature. So he's not anti-materialist so much as trying to bind materialism into something higher, so that in the end you get a sort of realist idealism. He's a Christian Neoplatonist. He's worked with the Temenos Academy that promotes precisely that legacy and also recognizes traces of it in Islam and other traditions, in Buddhism and so on. It is a very significant position, and I think both for culture, but also for politics in the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth, this could be a very significant reign.
You've described him as a Neoplatonist, essentially someone who asks the questions that Plato asks: what constitutes the good life?
Exactly. And he's also, like a philosopher king, trying to hold everyone, including himself, to higher standards of justice, because he recognizes that everything has an intrinsic good. All human activities, but nature as well, have intrinsic goods. And it's those goods we have to uphold. That's what we should be judged by. And he would not in any way suggest that he is doing that all the time, that, you know, he has somehow reached a level of truth that others haven't. He's just trying to hold us all to much higher standards than we have been judged by.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West. I'm speaking with Professor Adrian Pabst of the University of Kent. Adrian, there's a very real debate going on in Australia, but also in other parts of the Commonwealth, specifically those countries that were colonised by the British, about the legacies of colonialism, the violence, the slavery. I'm wondering whether post-war modern Germany might provide a model here, because I know that there was a lot of debate in the first few years after World War II about Germany making amends for the awesome tragedy of the Holocaust. But in the end, Germany came to be seen as almost a model state in being able to face up to its dark history. Is there something that Charles can do on a similar level?
So I think what he can do is provide some leadership and create a space in which people can express far more than has already been the case. But I think that may also be a role that might fall to his son, William, now the Prince of Wales. Because on his recent tour to the Caribbean, William spoke at quite some length about the darker sides of colonial history, about the deep stain of slavery, and also acknowledged that there may be countries that may choose in the end to abolish the monarchy and not to have the king as the head of state. And that would then apply not just to Charles, but of course to William himself. And so they are already saying, of course, the peoples and nations of the Commonwealth are free and should be free to choose how they are governed. But I think, yes, Charles will articulate this. And the question is, can Britain as a country follow and take up this new space that he's helping to create in order to engage with that history? I think that's going to be the big question, because in Germany, it was very much a collective effort. It wasn't just down to, you know, a few enlightened men, as it were. It was a national effort, and I think that's what it needs to become in the UK as well.
There's an aesthetic to Charles as well that reminds me of Ruskin, John Ruskin, the Romance philosopher and writer and art critic. And that is, there's something innately in his soul about the countryside, isn't there? And this informs, I think, a lot of his philosophy.
Absolutely. I mean, if Charles was a politician, and he isn't, we'd call him a Tory socialist. But fundamentally, what there is in Charles is what I would call a form of romanticism. Charles is really a romantic in the philosophical, in the religious and metaphysical sense. He believes that the world itself, beauty in the natural world, is an indication of God's creation and God's grace. And that therefore we need to strive to preserve that beauty, to try and enhance it through architecture and urban planning and so on. But also that fundamentally, it is about beauty, goodness, and truth, those three transcendentals, trying to somehow ally them. And that's what Romanticism sought to do. And he is, in that sense, an unreconstructed romantic, not a sentimentalist, not someone who believes that everything's fine or there's a golden age to which we shall return. He wants to help articulate that complex relationship of the true, the beautiful, and the good. And I think that is a really significant vision, and one I think many people intuitively will share. It's inchoate, of course, but I think there is a sort of sense in which he can lead where others haven't, and perhaps help redirect the economy, politics, and culture towards something transcendent, something that has enduring universal meaning and value.
And according to a piece in that very interesting journal, The Critic, if anything, Charles sees his great enemy as modern corporate capitalism.
Absolutely. And he's spoken at length about how modern corporate capitalism has been destructive, not only of the environment, though that has been, you know, one of the worst side effects, but also how it's left a whole generation out of jobs, without employment, without any job that has meaning, and left a whole generation of young people scarred, and often scarred for life, because they didn't have the institutions to support them to get through these economic crises that Charles lived through already in the 70s. Capitalism is something that Charles has repeatedly criticized alongside with modern bureaucracy. And at the heart of this is essentially his point that modernism is on the side of the impersonal, the inhuman. And the real pivot is between that and the human and the personal. And the monarchy is, of course, all about personal rule. So why are people so touched by the passing of Queen Elizabeth? Because they felt that there was something always personal about this. This was always about the person who was the head of state, not some impersonal bureaucracy or some merely elected politician who then wouldn't really try and embody the nation. It's the personal that people want more of. And Charles can give expression to that centrality of the personal.
Very good to speak with you, as always, Professor Adrian Pabst of the University of Kent. Adrian's latest book, by the way, is Post-Liberal Politics, The Coming Era of Renewal. We did a program on that at the start of this year. Adrian, thank you very much for coming back to the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Real pleasure being with you.
That ends today's Religion and Ethics Report. You can follow us at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Hong Jiang and Hamish Camilleri. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.